if you give five people a task of writing a blog post, they'll all use probably ChatGPT, but one of them will still be better than other four. So there is still that human element, which sort of a taste-making ability that changes when one of the person has the ability to understand what actually makes a good post.
Welcome to the Learn It All podcast with your hosts, Learn It CEO, Damon Lemby, and SVP of Product, Darren Bridget. Our mission is to explore how continuous growth shapes the path to success. Our guests are high achievers who've learned there's always something new to discover. They'll share their stories, strategies, and insights with you. So whether you're a budding entrepreneur, a seasoned executive, an aspiring athlete, or simply someone who believes in the lifelong pursuit of knowledge, this podcast is for you. Join us now for the latest episode as we continue the Learn It All's journey through a world that never stops teaching.
Welcome to another episode of the Learn It All podcast. 3/4 of all knowledge workers are now using generative AI, and that number has nearly doubled in the past 6 months. We are Damon Lemby of Learn It and Courtney Ritchie, Director of Learning Experience. Today, we are joined by our guest, Nataraj Sindham. Nataraj is a senior product manager at Microsoft. He's host of the startup podcast that he had me on as a guest. And he's also an angel investor and author of 100 Days of AI, an educational series on AI. Nataraj, good to see you, buddy.
Hey, Devin. Thanks for having me on the show.
It's great to have you here. Can we start off? Can you give us a little background on your journey?
Yeah, sure. So I'm Nataraj. I grew up in South India in a small town. Studied math and computer science in India. And then I got hired by this company called Epic Systems, which is based in Madison, Wisconsin. That's how I got to move to the US. So I sort of moved from a tropical 25 degrees Celsius weather to a minus 10 degrees Celsius weather in November 2013. So I directly went from very normal climate to a snow-filled Wisconsin. So that was an interesting change. Worked at Epic, developed healthcare products. So Epic is one of the largest electronic healthcare record company. So worked there as a software engineer and product developer. Got to do a lot of interesting things. One of the things Epic is known for is they always send their employees to observe their customers. So got to visit a lot of interesting places that I would otherwise not visit in my life. Like, I was in hospitals observing how doctors used software, how healthcare professionals use software. So from front desk to inpatient therapy to physicians, surgeons. So it was an interesting observation of how technology can impact sort of one of the most fundamental aspects of humanity, which is healthcare. So we did a lot of interesting things in that space. Developed from products from scheduling payments to interactions with patients and documenting that in software, and tried to do that in a sort of a customer friendly way. So after working at Epic, then I moved to Microsoft. Right now I work at in a product called Azure Files, where we store a lot of unstructured data in Azure Files, and unstructured data is where pretty much all the AI buzz is happening right now. Before that, I worked in a couple of products, including Microsoft 365, Azure Stack, which is sort of like Azure in a box, where customers want Azure on-premises. So Azure Stack is sort of like a hardware plus software product that gets delivered to customers and they can use in parallel with Azure Cloud. So after doing a bunch of things, now I'm currently a product manager in Azure Files. Before that, I was also a software developer within Microsoft. That's a little bit of background about me.
I love your diverse background and story. One of the things that I first noticed when I went to your website was the 100 Days of AI. Can you share with us a little bit what inspired you to author that, and what key insights have you come up with through that journey?
Yeah, I mean, like everyone, when ChatGPT sort of exploded, I was also sort of blown away with the technology. And if you are a software engineer by profession, like pretty much all software engineers, in big tech do machine learning. And there's this very famous course by Andrew Ng, who is now currently on the board of Amazon. And Andrew Ng is sort of like the iconic figure in the field of machine learning, especially as an educationalist. He founded deeplearning.ai. And he has this amazing courses, very long form, in-depth courses to teach machine learning. So you see almost all software engineers who want to pursue or expose to machine learning take this course in deep learning. So I took that course about five years back when I first joined Microsoft, and understood like what the cutting edge of Microsoft, machine learning is. But then I didn't really, you know, focus a lot on it. But then after ChatGPT, I realized that this is, you know, truly important and truly foundational. So I wanted to sort of take time to spend more time and to understand what is happening at a cutting edge level. So my background in machine learning and mathematics obviously helped. So I said, okay, in 2024, I'll spend 100 days, just 2-3 hours a day, spend on learning and, you know, going deep into LLMs, large language models, you know, what sort of applications can we build, what is the impact going to be, and just do experiments and play around and come up with ideas and also share those in the form of blog posts. So I call it 100 Days of AI and just started documenting those. And it's mostly an exercise of curiosity plus, you know, just learning. And because, you know, I think when engineers were doing machine learning, or when I was doing machine learning 5 years back, I couldn't squint and see the future beyond what was there. You know, natural language processing is, you know, what offer it was referred to, which today is referred to as, you know, large language models. But we couldn't see how it would improve applications beyond what we were already doing in Google search, or beyond what, you know, we are doing recommendation systems, for example, and Netflix was pioneering recommendation systems, which got eventually into Amazon and all the other websites where you can see, you know, objects being recommended based on your behavior and different data points. So when you squint really hard, you couldn't see a future beyond that. At least I couldn't. But with large language models, and if you squint hard enough, you can see, you know, the future around the corner just with the current technology that we have, without any new innovations. And obviously, we'll have some more new innovations. So that sort of led to, you know, do this exercise, and it definitely sort of reinforce the fact that this is a very foundational transformative technology, and it's a horizontal technology. So it will affect all industries and sectors. It's hard really to think of a sector that it will not affect. So that's some of the background where, you know, why I started 100 Days of AI and why I was documenting it.
Let me ask you, just to take a step back, for us novices out there, can you explain a little bit what large language models are?
Sure. So what is essentially happening, I mean, I'll explain the process and maybe that sort of explains what they actually are. It's actually a probabilistic equation, what is happening behind the scenes. So for example, whenever you're talking to ChatGPT, you're talking to a model behind the scenes. And when you're saying, you know, they're actually a predicting machines. So they're not actually intelligent in a way that we are intelligent. They're actually predicting machines. So for example, you ask them, if you give a series of texts, let's say, what is your first? And you give a blank. What they're trying to do is they're trying to predict, okay, what is the next token or word that is of highest probability? And the way the model actually tells you that, or returns you something, or completes that sentence or words, is basically behind the scenes, it is building a large probabilistic equation. And how does it build that equation? That's where the training that you often hear, you know, for example, I give it a book of text, right? Or a paragraph of text to the model. What it learns is if you take a sentence, and from that sentence, it learns that, okay, if I've given the first two words, I have to predict the third word. If I've given first three words, I have to predict the fourth word. Now, that's the information that it is learning and creating a probabilistic equation, essentially, behind the scenes. So when you train it on just one paragraph, its prediction capabilities are, you know, pretty much to zero, because the equation from one paragraph, how much can you learn from one paragraph? But you take the entire text on the internet, you know, I think GPT-3 was trained for around 45 terabytes. You can say, why is internet only 45 terabytes? You know, internet is actually in petabytes, but when you compress this pure text that they actually want to train on, it actually came about to 45 terabytes, and they train on this 45 terabytes of pure text, then it starts to get good at predicting or completing a text. That's what essentially a large language model does.
I'm obviously selfishly curious about this concept of knowledge work and how AI is going to be reshaping that. You know, Damon mentioned at the beginning that over 3/4 of the world are, you know, using AI now. So I'm curious, from where you sit and all the knowledge that you're trying to glean on this technology, how do you see AI reshaping knowledge work, and specifically the product management space? I know you specialize in. What are the impacts going to be, and how is it going to shift the entire model of knowledge work?
Yeah, I mean, so any big wave, right? When there is any technology wave, I think the two ways to look at it. One is it could become a threat to an existing sort of status quo, and then you could look at it and say, okay, this is a great opportunity. So I'm sort of looking at it as a second part, like it's a great opportunity to rethink a lot of things. And whenever we've seen that a new technology has come, we've shifted our sort of abstraction level at which we humans work. Like there's this great example that, you know, 100 years back, humans were hired to sit in a room and do mathematical calculations. So, you know, people were actually hired just to do, you know, additions and subtractions in a room. From there, we went on to create, you know, abacus, and then, you know, calculators, and then computers. We're still doing math, but we're doing it at a different abstraction level. So I think that's the way to best think about, you know, knowledge work as well. So, you know, we were still, you know, 10 years back, 20 years back, we're still writing blog posts. You know, we'll still be writing blog posts, but it will be more computer-assisted blog posts. You know, if you give, you know, 5 people a task of writing a blog post, they'll all come up, they'll all use probably ChatGPT, but one of them will still be better than other 4. So there is still that human element, which sort of a taste-making ability that changes when, you know, one of the person has the ability to understand what actually makes a good blog post and what actually, because there's not just writing the structure, writing the flow, or concluding it, right? It's about, you know, what's the point? What is the storytelling? Can you say something differently? So all these things you have to consider when you're writing a blog post. So I think we'll still do the same thing, but we'll do it at a different abstraction level. So you can apply sort of this to a different, take any knowledge work, right? If you're an accountant, you would still have to go through that training of understanding, you know, what a balance sheet is, or, you know, how the technical terms work, what is the legalese around accounting. But maybe you'll not spend more time making tables and doing calculations, but maybe just verifying it, right? And some AI does a lot of work that you do, and then you become the verifier. Like even in case of lawyers, and I was just looking at an application the other day, you know, immigration is such a complex and costly affair because lawyers are limited and lawyers' time is very costly. But there are companies now which are automating a lot of work that, you know, otherwise required paralegals or lawyers to look at. So they'll still, you'll still need a lawyer's expert opinion, but you'll only need 1 hour instead of 10 hours of lawyer's time. So it is more like, you know, the abstraction level at which we will work changes specifically for knowledge work. For, I think, product managers, I think it's a great opportunity to make careers. I think generative is sort of like the best way I can describe it as like intelligence as a service. So you have now this, you know, sort of API. In the form of API, you can actually get intelligence, whether it's OpenAI, Anthropic, or Google Gemini, or Microsoft Phi. You're basically getting from an API some intelligence back. So you can use that to create things that were otherwise not possible. And we're already seeing that, right? You know, Microsoft launched this application called Recall, where you can search. It's sort of like searching from your memory. It's not, because you're browsing, you're context switching, everyone has this 100 apps open at any given of time, given time, but no one remembers, you know, what I've done there. So you're wasting a lot of time in context switching. So I think a lot of these second order problems are going to be solved because of this new intelligence as a service. And even for product managers, I think, I feel product manager's job is to provide clarity, right? You take all this, you know, knowledge, all this, you know, a little bit of chaos that exists right now in generative AI, and extract value out of it. You know, what really matters at the end of the time is, you know, implement that generative AI in your product in a way that it's valuable to your customers. So it starts with, you know, okay, this is all good. You know, this is all, there's a little bit of hype. There's some fanciness going on, but how can you really use it to your own product? And I think there's some great examples, right? For example, Notion, you know, when GPT-3 came, they launched a lot of features, which is, you know, summarizing text, easily generating text. Because Notion obviously is dealing with a lot of text, it's almost like a perfect application. But I would say you could go beyond, if you're a startup or a product manager working in a startup, you can actually rethinking how note-taking should happen. Like, is Word or Notion really the abstraction level, how we should write notes? Or can we come up with a new form factor? I think this idea of coming about from new software form factors is something I'm really excited about, and I think we'll see a lot more. I think Recall is sort of like the first application, which is like newly we are rethinking. Till now, we've only saw like, okay, Notion embedded AI in its own app. We are doing customer support. I think customer support, I think it's Klarna who did a full-on customer support revamp in their organization and saved like, you know, tens of millions of dollars for their company. But I think I'm still waiting to see a more, you know, first principle-based new products that will really, you know, change a lot of sectors and industries and deliver a lot more customer value. I think we are yet to see that. I think we'll see in the next couple of years, because right now the more hype is at a foundational layer level and not application layer level. In a way, you can say Perplexity is a little bit like that, because they're focused on summarizing, or the way we search is slightly being changed. I think we are going from like, you know, searching to answering. We went from, okay, we'll search and we'll get 10 boop links back, but now we go and ask and we get an answer back. So I think there are some second order shifts that are happening. Perplexity on a consumer level is different. There's Jasper.ai or Copydate AI. They're sort of changing how you write, you know, for the purposes of marketing or for different purposes where you are using writing, essentially. So I think we are yet to see a breakout new, like fully AI first app. But having said that, AI also has been there in a lot of apps that we don't generally associate it with AI. I think Google is getting a lot of criticism right now that it's been slow and everything, but Google actually did a lot of interesting things. Especially if you're a Pixel phone user, Google did a lot of interesting things in AI before anyone else. And the great example for that is Google Photos. And Google search answers, like even though Perplexity is saying that they are the first to launch, the answers in Google have been launched, I think, in 2016. So summarizing an answer on the search itself was launched pretty early. And Google also has this amazing feature where, you know, we all hate waiting for a customer rep to come online. It will take 30, 40 minutes, right? And Google has this amazing feature called Hold For Me. That's also AI. People don't associate it with AI, but Google has done a lot of interesting product features that are, you know, sort of submerged under the product, and we generally don't associate it with, you know, generative AI or AI. And in fact, the best of features are also like the AI features which don't look like AI features. They just solve a customer problem. I think you're on mute.
Damon, you're on mute.
Sorry about that. Nataraj, I was reading somewhere. Now, Google search is changing, right? Is it changing more towards conversational search?
They're definitely adding conversational features, because right now, and they're rolling out, this used to be part of Search Labs, which is, if anyone is interested in like upcoming features of Google, they have to go and sign up for Search Labs, where all the cutting edge features are given to you first. So in that program, it has been there for last 1 year, where almost pretty much everything you search, you get an answer for it immediately. So that is your first summarized answer. And there's an immediate chat option where you can chat with an answer, just like a ChatGPT sort of experience or a Perplexity like experience. My thesis is that the second order effect is going to be that we are moving from search to answer. And it's interesting to see how the whole ad business model is going to change. I think there are a lot more second order effects here, because web itself has been going small. You know, the incentive to create new websites has been going down. Like, there's no new incentive for creators to create new websites. So if you do that, the web actually becomes more centralized, as the internet itself becomes more centralized, lesser number of players. You could say there are newer websites, but there is no newer substantial websites where people are spending time. If you look at where people spend time, that has been being centralized, even though there are newer websites, but those new websites don't get traffic. So there's this big second order problem of what will happen to web and what will be happening to web-based business models. So there's also this panic among, you know, media businesses that how will we get traffic if everything is an answer and not a link. Google claims that, you know, you'll get much better answers if you sort of have a domain authority in one particular domain. But I think it's also a hint at centralization, that there are only so many niches in the world. Like, okay, let's say education or like high school education. I think the one or two websites will get all the traffic because they have the source of truth and they have the established domain authority. So anyone too new to break out, the barrier of entry is going to be much, much, much higher. I think the barrier of entry of like just SEO optimization has been much, much higher in any new field or any existing field. So I think we are going to see some really interesting second order effects in web itself because of this search to answer transition.
Interesting. Now let's move in this direction for a second. You know, a lot of our audience are potentially looking for a career change. What advice do you have for individuals who would like to become a product manager? Where should they start?
I'll give a take that why I became a product manager, and hopefully that helps people. I was originally a software developer, and I, for most of my career, I've been a full stack software developer. Then I realized I was sort of trying to find my person market fit. You know, just like people look for product market fit, I was trying to find what is the best, you know, person career fit that I could have. And that led to me becoming a product manager, that sort of self-reflection. So everyone has to identify their own strengths, you know, on what they're good at, what they can become good at. You know, if they're learning something, there's always this concept of flow that they, you know, get at when they're doing something. So I think it depends on, you know, you have to do that self-evaluation for yourself. And if you're interested in business, if you're interested in tech business, and if you're relatively good at tech, then you can, I think of becoming product manager. But product manager also is a broad term. There are a lot of different types of product managers, right? For example, I define my role as sort of like a cloud product manager, where it's, you know, it's much more technical. You have to understand how the cloud works, how distributed computing works. You have to understand, you know, the technical concepts more than a regular product manager. But if you're a consumer product manager, it's slightly different. If you're a growth product manager, it's again, you have to be really interested in growing products. And how do you think about growing products, whether it's B2C or B2B? Have you grown any products? Have you tried growing any products? And have you been successful at it? And have you found enjoyable doing that? So then you can move to growth product manager. So I think becoming product manager, I would say, is an intersection of, are you good at understanding tech, depending upon, and how much tech is dependent on what kind of product management role you want to get into? And then are you interested in the business of technology? Because most product manager jobs in technology. And are you generally interested in business? Because product managers are sort of like, you know, for CEO. People say, you know, you're a CEO of a product, but you're not. But yeah, you do focus on things that a CEO does focus on. So growing the business, growing the top line, bottom line, you know, profitability. So are you really interested in business? And then do you have like some of the soft skills? Because product managers should have some of the soft skills, especially like, do you have storytelling capacity? Can you, you know, convince people about the thesis that you have, you know, on what direction the market is taking or where the customers are, on why some experiment is worth doing or some experiment is not worth doing? So I think a combination of these three things makes you a good product manager, and you have to evaluate it for yourself. Experiment a little bit, learn a little bit, and see how it goes, and then decide to transition to product management. For me, I was lucky because I was working with product managers. I was looking at it, and I sort of through self-reflection realized that how you know, deeply I was interested in just the business of technology. I was investing outside the company, so I was already into, you know, tech in a deeper way that made sense for me to move as a product manager. And people around me were telling me that, hey, you know, product management is a better career path for you. And I also felt that working with great engineers, great software developers, I knew that I was not top 1% of engineers. That led me to become, okay, where can I be top 1%? Okay, engineering, I am good. I can do the job for the next 20 years, but it is, you know, it's like this. Everyone is talking about NVIDIA H100s, right? The chip that sort of powers all LLM training. And people often say this phase that, you know, work hard, you can do anything. Then I'll tell them, okay, take a CPU and make it work hard and create an LLM. It doesn't happen. It will take infinity to make it happen. So it is like people are born with different types of CPUs and GPUs. So you have to evaluate with your CPU what really works, or GPU what really works. You can't outwork Elon because he has an H100 in his head and you have a regular Intel CPU on your head. So you cannot become an Elon just by working hard. That's a myth the world tells you. Yes, hard work takes you a long way, but it has its limitations, and not everyone can. Everyone does the same hard work. And let's say everyone does the same hard work. Can everyone create a Tesla? No. So it's just brutal truth. So you have to evaluate, like, which skills are you better at and where you can find your superpower, and, you know, transition into that rather than like struggling really, really hard in something. And even like one of the founders I was talking to, he said, I wish someone told me this 10 years back that successful products, which will become big, sort of give you that signal very early on, not like after 2 years, 3 years, but you get that customer signal very, very early on. So so it's better off to sort of like, when you're early in your career, experiment with a lot of things so that you really find that one thing that clicks, instead of like focusing a lot and grinding it out and, you know, saying that, you know, hard work will reach you everywhere. Of course you need hard work, but I feel that a lot of people don't focus on the direction. That's my long-winded answer of how to become a product manager.
I liked the comparison to Elon's CPU. It's a little different. For a lot of the people that you know, listen to this and we work with, you know, they're dipping their toes in. There's a lot of trepidation about where to even begin. And one of the questions that I have, just as a foundational understanding, is the competitive landscape of AI, right? There's what people have access to at their fingertips. I think most people are aware of, you know, ChatGPT is being kind of something they can just go get right now. Can you maybe kind of walk through who the key players are in the competitive landscape that is AI right now, and what their big movements are, what they're going to be doing, and what we should expect to see from them in the next 6 to 12 months?
Yeah. So I think in terms of like the landscape, I think you could define, I think there are foundational model players, you know, like the OpenAIs and Cohere, Anthropics, Google AI or Microsoft's, who are training these large language models. So they are, and in that, what we can see next coming is this multimodal models. We are already seeing GP4o, which is sort of like multimodal model. I think we'll also see a lot more video and multimodal models coming out from foundation models. And compute and the cost of compute and the efficiency of creating a large language model is gonna be increased, and sort of like the cost is gonna come down heavily. Like if I have to predict on what's gonna happen on foundational models direction. Just continuing on the landscape thing, I think you have foundational model, and above that, you have sort of like a tooling slash orchestration companies. You have like, you know, LangChain, GPT Index, you know, who are sort of enabling others to build applications. So that's actually a pretty thriving ecosystem right now. And on top of that, you have like these new applications, you know, like, you know, the Jasper AI or GitHub Copilot or Runway ML or ChatGPT. You can technically consider it as an application. And then there are like sort of existing applications within that application layer. You have like existing applications who are using AI to make their product better. So that would be like Notions and the Klarnas of the world. It could be any application really, who are, you know, actively embedding AI to make the product better. And even like below the foundational layer, you have sort of like the operations or enabling foundational model layer companies. There's a company in Seattle called OctoML. There's an interesting company called Lamini. which is started by a bunch of PhDs to enable training and inference, you know, faster with AMD chips. So here, these are companies which are enabling inference layer, training layer, and sort of like data orchestration for pre-training, before pre-training, or like collecting the data. So you could put Databricks also in this sort of layer. You have companies like Mosaic ML, which are acquired by Databricks. And I think below all this, I think we have is the cloud layer, which is sort of being used in all these layers, and which is sort of like having its own new, so you could say a new wave of cloud computing because of how much compute and storage is needed for developing this entire stack. And again, before below cloud, you have the silicon layer, which is even NVIDIA and pretty much every big tech company is now doing silicon and sort of trying to do their own TPUs and GPUs. So I think that's broadly, I would say, what does the landscape look like? But in terms of like opportunity, I think application is the biggest opportunity. Foundation models has really high barrier. But I think there's also this notion of, foundation models will eventually reach out to the same capability. But what does that mean as an investor or someone who wants to create a new foundation model, if you're already in that, is that the space is still early and you should go and do that. I wouldn't say that just because we have five players, we shouldn't do that, because, remember Google was what, 16th search engine. In spite of all these companies, like Mistral suddenly became popular because they're much more efficient in terms of like cost and performance wise, because they have a very good balance. They're able to achieve a lot of better performance with much lesser cost, and they have like an innovative way of doing it. So there's a lot more innovation in foundation models before it gets commoditized. It might be true in 20 years, but to get there, a lot more innovation has to happen. A lot more unicorns have to be created in that space before it actually gets commoditized. I think that's how sort of like the landscape is looking right now.
So one question I have for you, and from listening to all this, which I think is great, is obviously you're curious, you're a lifelong learner, and now for the last 7+ years, you've been at Microsoft, which has gone through an amazing transformation under Satya Nadella. And, he advocates, and he talks about this in his book, Hit Refresh, I think it's called. Yeah, that's right. And about advocating for a learn-it-all culture, which obviously we're big fans of. How have you experienced that firsthand at Microsoft?
Yeah, definitely. I think when Satya came to Microsoft, when he became the CEO, I think he did two things which sort of really set the stage. I think one is he sort of defined the vision or like what Microsoft is very well, which I think this Ballmer era sort of lacked, which is sort of to say that Microsoft empowers everyone to their, to do their job, essentially. That's what he defined. I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but that sort of one line sort of puts Microsoft in the right position. I think he understood really well what Microsoft's role in the world is. And that really one sentence sort of makes it clear. You don't have to go beyond like, what is Microsoft? And I think during the Steve Ballmer era, I think there was a little bit of, what is Microsoft? It does so many things, but what is Microsoft? Like no one really understood it. I think that's one thing he really did, sort of set the narrative in terms of what Microsoft will be doing. And it also flows down across why they acquired LinkedIn, why they acquired GitHub. When you look at it from that one line, it all makes sense. So I think that's one thing he did to sort of set the stage for everything else. And the second thing is this internally, I think to set the culture right with this, you have to be a learn it all versus a know it all. And that's constantly reinforced within the company. It also makes people be more empathetic towards their coworkers. Because often what happens is you don't want to have a douche who's very intelligent or who's very productive, but you want someone who's enabling, who's intelligent but also enabling others. So I think a lot of this is sort of embedded into the culture of Microsoft, last 7-8 years. So it's a constant reinforcement that you have to be continuously learning, be curious. And even though like these are simple things, I think, my understanding is all strategy is pretty simple. But it's hard to do. So I think curiosity or learn it all. Yeah, everyone knows, you know, learning. Yeah, everyone just learn everything. But, you know, it's sort of like going to the gym. We go to the gym, you get fit, but it's hard because it's hard to do every day. So it's sort of this simple philosophy of learn it all and versus know it all. So you're always sort of coming up, any meeting you go to, any customer call you go to, you're coming up with an approach of learning something new and trying to make sure that you're getting to the truth of the matter rather than coming at it with an approach of, you know, I already know this. And that makes a difference across the stack, whether you're in, you know, trying to get a product spec, or whether you're working with engineers, or whether you're working with customers, whether you're working with other partner or teams. And it's also emphasized at every level. It's not just engineers or product managers. It's emphasized at management level. It's how you're judged inside your performance, you know, at whatever role, on how you're helping others learn, or, you know, how you're helping others is a big part of, you know, how being a Microsoft employee. So it's sort of like not just words, but they flow into like a specific action at each individual role and sort of defines on how your career, you can't just fake it, that you can't just say it, learn it all, learn it all, learn it all. And it doesn't happen that your career will not move forward. You have to show it, right? So yeah, I think it sort of set the right culture across all teams.
I think what you said is incredible. You know, you brought up two points, and this is important for all you small business owners out there. If you manage a team or if you manage a large organization, is really around the vision, focusing on what your vision is and what's your purpose. Because I see that a lot working with our customers and some of the people I mentor, is that people are just kind of confused. Like, we go in so many different directions. We try so many new things. You know, who are we? And I think that what you brought up right there is critical. And I'm sure Courtney will agree, in our world, we, you know, our ears light up when you talk about learning. And it's true. Learning is tough. It doesn't happen easy. And it's great to see a culture where and it shows up in, you know, what Microsoft's been able to accomplish through cloud computing and moving over 365 over to a subscription. And now, of course, with AI, is just the evolution of what you've come through. And it's great to see. Do you have any tips, any quick tips on for a small business owner, how they can develop an or like a starting point to develop more of a learning all culture?
I'd say, I mean, right now there are a lot of interesting resources. I think, you know, YouTube is a great resource. I think one of the problems of this sort of time that we're living in is the signal to noise ratio. I think finding the right people and finding the right content to follow is like the biggest challenge, because you're bombarded with so much, I'd say, nonsense into your feed or, you know, whatever application that you're using. So I think it's sort of finding that signal to noise. And I think the best way to find signal is, I think, books that are older, someone who has built a reputation through a lifelong work, you know, brands that have, you know, not taken cheap shortcuts, you know, even learning brands who have existed for 20 plus years. I think that's how you have to go a little bit long term. Explore some of these resources before you fall into the traps of, you know, social media or the age where every random person sort of becomes a philosopher and guide and, you know, tries to talk to camera by, you know, watching camera and as if someone is being interviewed, and pushing content in social media in a way that, you know, everyone is sort of gullible to believing in. So I think it's important, I would say, is to sort of finding signal from the noise and finding the right people and the right resources to follow, and just going back to the basics. And I think that applies to all of us.
I would love just one thing. I know we didn't talk too much about your investing, but as someone who is always trying to be more diverse in their investment, and for a lot of people that listen are probably a little nervous to get into the space for that exact reason, right? Everyone's a philosopher. It's hard sometimes for the novices to tell what's authentic and what's truly going to be changing the landscape and what's maybe a flash in the pan of excitement. What advice do you have for people when they're going to the AI sector to start investing?
I would say any investing, I think people should read 2 or 3 books on that type of investing before getting into there. I think 2-3 books, if you read on any investing, I think you'll be way ahead in terms of identifying good resources, what is fluff versus what is reality. And I think you can sort of, then you'll be equipped with the tools to do. So if you are getting into real estate, even read bad books. I would say at least read 2-3 books. And it would take you maybe, 3-4 months. And 3-4 months would not set you back in any ways. And then when I got into angel investing, it's because I was reading a lot of books and I sort of by chance read some of the books on angel investing. There's a book called Venture Deals by Bradfeld, which is actually a great book. I think the tagline is how to be smarter than your lawyer. If you read even half of that book, I think you'll be more smarter than most people in the startup industry. And you'll know all there is to know, all the basics that there is to know in how to write a safe and what does pre-money mean, post-money mean, convertible note, the stuff people are usually, unaware of the language of startups or the language of investing of startups. And then I read, Jason Callaghan's book on investing, and I read, some other books about angel investing. And that's how it led me into angel investing. So I would say, start by reading 2 or 3 books and take the hard pill early on. Because usually what we do is, I think right now, what we have is sort of like a sense of knowing it all. And that is coming because of seeing all these shorts, all these blogs. Before getting to shorts and blogs, which there is some incredible content, I would not say that there isn't, go back to the basic and read a book on that area. Like even real estate, I'm starting to read real estate books because, I want to invest more in real estate, but angel investing, it happened because I was reading books. It was not a plan that I would go and do angel investing, but it was an interesting book for me to understand because everyone talks about startups and, what the hell is this? Everyone, will claim I invested in that, I invested in this, but to really understand the basics, I think you still do the, the thing that we did in school. Just read 1 or 2 books and I think we'll get the most, and then we can build through blogs and charts. I think even for stocks, a lot of people who sort of get into stocks in the era of meme stocks lack foundations and like the foundation principles of like what compounding means, who are the greats of investing, what have they done, right? So I think we sort of miss that, and we eventually people come there, but it will take 4 or 5 years and some capital lost or gained, I don't know. But it will take some time to get there. But instead, I would say, take the hard pill first. And even in AI, and someone asking me, how to get into AI, I would say, take the hard pill first. Take the 6 months off and spend time on deeplearning.ai. Deeplearning.ai amazingly has different levels of courses. They have now short courses, like 1-hour courses. Which are very, very interesting. Even if you are wanting to learn just prompting, they have a course on prompting. It's not just for engineers and data scientists. It's actually for, any knowledge worker can do some of these courses in deeplearning.ai and, can get ahead of their colleagues. Before AI replaces a colleague who has better knowledge of AI will replace you. So if you want to get that promotion, I would say spend some time and doing some of these courses on deep learning, or if you're a middle manager or a professional, there's some very good courses. And Section is doing a lot of AI courses, and I'm sure you guys are doing courses on soft skills and other courses that you mentioned. So I think we should take the hard pill first. I think right now we sort of focus on blogs, charts, and sort of the easy methods. But I think we should take the hard pill first and then the easy things follow.
I think that's great advice. And for all our listeners, we just announced several AI courses. And if you listen to this, we'll put it in the show notes. We'll let you attend for free our first round of classes that we have on AI for business writing and AI for middle managers and AI to be more productive. Nataraj, you've given us a tremendous amount of insights today. One signature question that we have is, tell us something about you that most people don't know. We've had people come on this show and tell us that people would never know that they went to high school with Mark Hamill or that they love butterfly collecting. What is something about you that, say, for instance, your coworkers or your many fans that don't know about you?
I mean, most of my coworkers don't know about my podcast or Angel Investing. But I would say, like, I do CrossFit. I think most people don't know about that. Me, I don't look like that, so I should be way thin and way leaner than this. But yeah, I would say I'm a CrossFitter now. I'm in the cult of CrossFit.
Good for you. I probably need to get into CrossFit, but may not happen anytime soon. So today in our conversation, we touched on a lot of great subjects. We talked about Microsoft and the two things you thought they've done well. We went pretty deep into AI, and I loved how you talked about rolling up your sleeves and doing the hard things first. Get in and do classes, do some work. We also spoke about angel investing and getting started, you know, reading a couple of books that we'll also put those in the show notes. And another area I liked is you talked about focusing on strengths. You know, not all of us have the same CPU levels. And even though you may be passionate about something, you got to be realistic and self-aware of where things are at and where you can be successful at. So, Nataraj, where can our audience, where can they reach out and learn more about you?
Yeah, you can visit my website, thestartupproject.io, where I have all my blogs, podcasts, any ideas. Or you can reach me on LinkedIn or Twitter. You can search for Nataraj Spacendam and you'll find me.
Well, thank you. And for our listeners out there, thank you for joining us today for another episode of the Learn It All podcast. And as we like to say here, stay curious and keep learning. Have a great day, everyone.